Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here, certainly in this beautiful place. And this week, I think, with the remembrances and recollections that we are having on 50 years of knowledge about perhaps the destruction of the world or the possible destruction of the world through nuclear war, I think it's time to reflect critically on how it is that human beings are violent. You can't hear? Okay, there's a microphone. Should there be a microphone
be
on?
It's not amplified.
Okay, well, I can speak up. Okay, if you can't hear me, raise your hand, because I can usually speak loud enough for everyone to hear me. Okay, so what I want to do tonight is I want to do three things, and I'm going to try and do it in an hour. This is usually an hour and a half presentation, but we're lucky tonight to have with us representatives of the culture that I study, and I think there's no one better to talk about nonviolence and pacifism than the people who have lived it and taught me about it. So we have as our guest tonight, and who will also answer questions for you, Hutterites themselves. And we have John Stahl of Stahlville Colony, his wife Elizabeth, Kay Woolman, his sister, and her daughter. So we have three generations of Hutterites here who I think will be willing to share their wisdom with you. So I'm going to try and keep my formal cross-cultural and sociological comments to a minimum, show you slides of Hutterite life, and then open our time for discussion. So I'm going to try and move fairly rapidly. So if you can't hear me or I'm talking too fast, slow me down or make me louder, and I can probably do both. I want to tell you that I share with you, any of you who've chosen to come tonight, your concern about violence. I think that most Americans are concerned about the ever-increasing amount of aggression that we experience today in American society. Whether you listen to the radio, you watch television, whether you read the newspaper, media representations of violence show us that in children's lives, in their schools, in our communities, whether you're on a bus, whether you're on the public roads, whether you're in public transportation, whether you're at work or whether you're at the streets, Americans all now may experience random acts of violence. Foreign vacationers are not safe in Florida anymore. We have marauding highwaymen and women who take advantage of our guests in our country. Families can't eat a hamburger at McDonald's these days in perfect safety as we once could. So how has American society become the most violent culture in the industrialized world? A few weeks ago, 60 Minutes reported that we now have the most murders in the world, and we have more guns for sale now that we have an assault weapon ban than we ever had before. So I could go on for hours and give you anecdotes, but since you came here to have me do more than make a speech, I want to concentrate on seven factors that I think are significantly associated with the escalating amount of violence and interpersonal aggression that we are experiencing in American society. But first, let me say that it is not aggression in and of itself that's the problem. Aggression is an evolutionary survival trait all human beings have, and we have it because we need it for survival. Human beings will fight to the death to protect their loved ones, and particularly kin and infants and vulnerable youths. So it's a survival trait. We share that with all other animals. However, human beings also share other traits with other social animals, and that is the trait of cooperation. So as a balance to aggression, human beings can suppress aggression in order to cooperate for group survival. So what we really are human beings with Stone Age physiology. Our physiology has not really changed and evolved for hundreds of thousands of years, while we live in cultures that have space age psychology. So instead of, in American society, emphasizing cooperation, we often glamorize and promote interpersonal competition and aggression. So what an anthropologist would say is that culture provides the framework which either supports or suppresses the innate evolutionary traits that help provide for our human survival. So behaviors that we value become largely unconscious part of the fabric of our society, and they form the basis for our worldview. Whether you're a Hutterite, whether you're an Amish, whether you're a non-Hutterite American citizen, or whether you're a member of any other foreign culture, your worldview is significantly shaped by the cultural context you grow up in. So our generalized American values are those that promote the aggression that we're experiencing in ever-escalating amounts today. So what I've done is make a chart for you. And these values may certainly not be your values, but sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists would all agree that these are generalized American beliefs and values. First, in America, we value individuality. We have a me mentality versus the we mentality that are promoted in many other cultures around the world. We are not communities. We are first and foremost individuals that live in a community. Okay. Two, we have materialism. In America, what you have is what you're worth. What you wear, what kind of car you drive, what kind of home you have, what kind of education you have. We measure ourselves in relation to others not by how we behave with each other, but by what we have materially, what we possess. Three, interpersonal competition. We believe in working hard and playing hard. We make heroes out of sports figures. We make heroes out of military figures. We rarely make heroes out of peace figures. The peace figures that may temporarily stop war, but generally our common American hero is someone who is a successful competitor and aggressor. Fourth thing that we have is a generalized belief and value that is not shared in most of the world is the nuclear family that is responsible for primary socialization. If any of you are here on Friday night, I'll probably be talking on kinship and the American family, and I'll go into how this functions as a significant variable in the kind of society and people we produce for our next generation. So what we expect in America is that two parents, and now in a society where there's a 50% divorce rate, one parent, it can be responsible for all aspects of a child's socialization to make them the responsible citizen for tomorrow. Most cultures around the world know better. We also believe in secular reasoning, the rational over the spiritual. So this is another very significant value. I think we all value separation of church and state. It's one of the things that has made America great. However, in America, many people believe you don't need a spiritual aspect to life. That's not common around the world. Power and punishment, use of force if necessary. We're at a time in history where we have no major aggressors, but we're at a time in history where France and the United States is considering resuming nuclear weapons testing. Think of that at a time when there's no one to compete or aggress with. So we believe that this is necessary, and we will kill in the name of preserving our right to our freedoms, which is a paradox. We also believe in new technology, and this cannot be underestimated, the importance of the technologies that we accept uncritically and uncontrolled and unevaluated until after the problems have resulted. Children seeing violent video games, violent Nintendo games, all kinds of violent activities that have not been controlled on television, and parents are busy working, and who's watching the store? Children are being socialized by remote through technologies that parents only secondhand hear about, the rap songs that the children are hearing, or the new music that they may be hearing before parents ever know about it. So these are seven variables that significantly impact our society and our worldview, and that make aggression much easier to accept, or at least harder to understand than in other cultures that understand that you must control for these things if you want to produce a non-aggressive society. So in contrast, many religious groups, particularly subcultural groups that are religiously structured, do not espouse these values. For instance, in the United States, Mennonites, Quakers, the Amish, and the Hutterites are notable exceptions because they're pacifists and they are conscientious objectors who have lived a history of nonviolence existing for over 450 years. So what I want to now do is move to other cultures and give you some examples of how other cultures structure their worldview. Many cultures around the world don't necessarily share or even value Americans' individualistic materialistic, and secular worldview. In fact, around the world, in cultures ranging from Asia to Africa, religious beliefs and shared spiritual rituals structure and frame all aspects of social life and people's daily activities. There's no separation of the spiritual from the rational or the spiritual from the activities of daily life. Also, in contrast to American society's restricted view of a secular sense of self, a view of the supernatural and a belief in the soul is widespread and a typical part of the worldview of most cultures around the world. So given Americans' generalized values, it's not surprising that in American society, our most dominant socialization practice with children is that we first and foremost teach them to be individuals. We also teach them to compete. Starting in grade school, children learn to value themselves by a material thing, grades. And they get to be valued as having value in relation to others based on how they compete in relation to others. So sociologists note that this has a significant impact on how people view themselves as either a part of the group or as individuals in relationship or opposition to a group. So social scientists would all tell you that for children, self-knowledge, self-esteem, and self-image develops as a part of socialization, and that they're all entwined with cultural patterns of activity, communication, and social relations. So developmental researchers would also tell you that the family is the prototype of the moral order. So when we're talking about what is right and wrong, what we value and what we don't value, we need to move to the family. And in most cultures around the world, they recognize the community is the source of socialization, not the individual nuclear family. And the extended kin system is also a significant part of the socialization network. So as opposed to American society, where we think child socialization should be the legal and moral responsibility of a couple or a single parent, in most of the world, these responsibilities are shared by much larger social groups, including extended families, which consist of several generations of relatives. According to developmental researchers, irrespective of the family socialization context, however, universally around age 2, as children begin to use language, it appears that hardwired in children's brains is the capacity to learn and know right from wrong. And this is very significant, because when we talk about whether we shape a person to be aggressive or to be cooperative, this happens very early in a child's life, the opportunity to learn how to view yourself in relation to others. So the sense of a moral sense of right and wrong is documented cross-culturally to be developmentally salient, to appear at about age 2. So what happens between 2 and 6 is critical to how the child begins to see themselves in relation to others. So anthropologists believe that a culture's ethos, that is their emotional worldview, has a significant bearing on the development of moral understandings in children. So it's not just the family, it's what the culture provides, what the child sees that's larger than what the family provides. So in America and cross-culturally, in families, members other than parents actually play a significant role in the development of moral understandings in children. Recent developmental research documents that affectionate older siblings and kin, other siblings in relationships that are emotional or social, children can influence small children's understandings of social roles and practices as early as 18 months of age in ways that parents cannot. So it's important that children have interactions with positive pro-social role models in children as well as having models in adults. So for example, if you're taking United States Hutterite culture, you can compare it to Kenyan African culture, which is rural and agricultural, and in both groups, which are agricultural communities, the extended kin system has large households that are both economic and social units, and in them, very early on, children are given independent caretaking responsibility for small children. So you're going to see in both in Africa and in Hutterite culture, as you will see in the slides, children as young as 6 and 7 years old having independent responsibility for children as young as a toddler. And they will have responsibility sometimes for several hours. Compare that with our generalized view in American culture that a child left alone with a younger sibling under 10 has a neglectful parent, and child protective services could be called in. Yet here we have a Western industrialized cultural group, the Hutterites, and an African traditionalist group who use the same socialization practices and who have the same outcomes in terms of cooperation and community support for child development and child socialization. However, the way this is done is that the whole community helps the younger children that are socializing the even smaller children. So in both cultures, adults and older siblings and family members make it clear to the younger children that you're never to strike or never to hurt a small child or an infant. And adult techniques for communicating these interpersonal values to children are talking to them, praise. In fact, in both cultures, Hutterite culture and African cultures in Kenya, the parents say to a 3 to 6 year old, they call them little mother and little father. They begin to socialize them for their cooperative and productive social roles and their relationships that early. They also will use corporal punishment on older children, but never the smaller children. And praise is foremost used to help mold and model appropriate behaviors. So anthropological research also documents that in families that are considered to be non-abusive and non-violent, and there are 27 cultures around the world that have been documented to be non-abusive and non-violent. So there are models that not only exist in the United States, but around the world for non-aggression. So in the families and in the cultures that have developed non-aggression and non-violence as a cultural value, in the families, there's a combination of loyalty, deference, empathy, altruism, love, and hierarchy, which protects the vulnerable from exploitation while it emotionally rewards the powerful for caring for the weak. And all of this is done without the costly devices of social welfare, police, and criminal justice systems. So it's what I've concluded, and anthropologists would conclude, is that it's the cultural group, not the child, nor the individual family, which decides which normative and regulatory rules and standards are important. So moral knowledge is culturally transmitted through role modeling, positive reinforcement, and social sanctions, where small children, as active moral reasoners, try to understand right from wrong. So, yet, as opposed to the socialization beliefs in the United States and Canadian Hutterite culture, in most of North America, the worldview of parents, particularly of adolescents, takes a sharp shift where in Hutterite culture, adolescents are given lots of structure and lots of direction regarding their future adult roles. We begin to let our children run free, particularly for adolescent males, at a time when Hutterites believe that you really need to keep them close and provide modeling for them. We often give them independence. And for children, particularly male children, who have not had enough nurturance and enough socialization, the damaging moral effect that the selective gender-based freedom can have is clearly confirmed that it is detrimental and it is destructive and is by the work of criminal justice and social science researchers. For example, research findings regarding American child molesters and rapists indicate that they started as adolescents and that they're males primarily, and they're males who didn't have male role models around. Or if they had male role models, they were aggressive and violent male role models. And that what they've found is they're not mentally ill, but they're very angry, they're very self-centered, and they lack empathy, and they have no moral understanding of themselves in relation to others. So in direct opposition to the moral characteristics which are cited as cross-culturally typifying healthy families, the backgrounds of most violent United States criminals are found to involve social isolation, lack of cohesion, and they're very dysfunctional in their families when they're rated on such interpersonal indexes as respect for others, conflict resolution, trust, autonomy, and intimacy. So essentially the families that are creating, or the lack of families that are creating the violence in America, is a product of the lack of cohesion, the lack of cooperation, and the lack of interpersonal dependency, and a spiritual base in a larger community which helps provide structure for children to believe that this represents the world they're growing into. So it appears that moral knowledge is culturally transmitted first and foremost within the family, where children transform what they're taught and experience into their own self-organized realities. So whether one is a American political liberal who sees our American violent generation of neglected and maltreated youth as a consequence of poverty, or whether you're a political conservative who thinks that our American youth violence stems from the decline of family values, the truth is both matter. And both are factors in the problem, as are the movies, the videos, and the television programs which glamorize violence while demonstrating that a meaningful life in America is to be achieved by possessing material things such as expensive clothing, exotic cars, elaborate houses, or having excess visible cash. And since we all know that humans, as sentient social beings, deeply desire self-fulfillment and social identity, why should we be surprised that the individuals most associated with violent behavior seek to achieve recognition in gangs or attempt to achieve sexual or social satisfaction by forcefully taking it from others? If who you are is what you have, and you can't afford it, and you can take it any way you want it, people will do that in America, and do that. So to conclude this part of my presentation, if the worldview of United States violent criminals can be summarized to be that of a self-centered moral detachment coupled with a lack of empathy for the feelings of others, then as proposed by many other social scientists, I believe it's critical for United States citizens to move beyond an intellectually detached stance of cultural denial to an emotionally attached cultural perspective regarding all of our responsibility for helping resolve our most pressing social problem. So I believe if we as Americans are really serious about disrupting the roots of violence as our contemporary affliction, we must move beyond pointing fingers to thinking about building a society that is less unequal, less depriving, less insecure, less disruptive of family and community ties, and less corrosive of cooperative values. So perhaps one way to begin to examine how we can do that is to explore how nonviolent American subcultural groups have done that. So what I would like to do is examine with you through slides the Hutterite culture to look at what characteristics they possess that are lacking in the larger cultural frame. With this in mind, I'm now going to show you slides of the cultural values and socialization practices of North American Hutterites. And like their Amish and Mennonite spiritual kin, theirs is not only a pacifistic society. Hutterites are unique in that they have lived for over 450 years as a communal society, meaning they share all their worldly goods. And they have lived together in the United States for 120 years and have never had a homicide. So I believe that they are excellent models for teaching us about how they manage to socialize for non-aggression. So Hutterites not only have never had a homicide, and they're now and growing daily, there are over 36,000 Hutterites in the United States, they're a society that does not have divorce, substance abuse, or significant systemic child maltreatment. So with that, I'd like to show you the slides, and what I will do is take you through essentially the Hutterite culture and have you examine how they have managed to transform aggression into productive economic and social competition for cooperation and mutual survival and support. So I guess, okay, you know what we're doing here? And if you can't hear me as I do the slides, I can certainly speak up because the fan will be on. And then what I want to do, oh good, I'm on target here. After the slides, I'm going to invite John Stahl up, and I think you really want to speak to the expert, ask him questions. We also have some expert ladies here, elders and youth, who I think can also answer questions for you that you may have. Okay, see if I can focus. Actually, I'm going to start your tour of nonviolent, non-aggressive societies in America on the East Coast with the Amish. The Amish have been in America for over 200 years.
We will fade out now while she's showing slides, and then we'll be back.
And they're really all spiritual kin. They know what is expected of them when they, at age 15, which is considered Hutterite adulthood, enter the world of adult society. And here you can see these are women getting ready for lunch. Because they're socialized to cooperate, you can have a room of 15 or 20 women preparing lunch for 50 or 60 people, and they won't run into each other, bump into each other, or make a mess. When I'm there, they have to get me out of the way. I'm trying to help out, but I'm not always very successful. And here are the Hutterite men coming in for lunch. This is on a Sunday for lunch. And the bell is rung for, very much like here, bells are rung for important events. And here are the elders sitting at their table. And this is the head table. You can tell by the beards where they're going, which direction they're going in. This is starting at the young end, looking at the women's table, moving across. And men and women do not sit together for meals. Mm-hmm. And actually, the woman without the shawl was the niece of one of the people on my PhD committee. And so they actually came over. They were German, so they came over to see what I was up to. And the economic life of a Hutterite colony is embedded in all aspects of their social life. So everyone works together for the common good. And socialization for adolescents, when we think of work as a drudgery or something separate from our social life, often romance, fun, and recreation and economic stability is part of the learning of a Hutterite youth, because romance often begins during the harvest season when Hutterite youth work together. This is looking at a machine shop, and Hutterites, as I say, not only use high technology, they will purchase whatever they need and the expertise to learn how to use it, and then they adapt it and modify it for their own good. And here you see the men in their workshops. And during the harvest season, they have their own trucks so that they can actually go out and take care of their own equipment. So they are very self-reliant on all aspects of their life. And so when a Hutterite adolescent male is moving into adult male life, he will have a chance to take on every occupation, from the pig barn to the milking operation to machinery to computers, if that's a part of the colony life. So they will essentially have an opportunity to try their hand at whatever to find out what they're good at. For females, it's often similar. Young unmarried females will work at occupations like the business occupations, and as well as learning how to be homemakers, how to sew, how to work as a communal cook, and participate in communal life. And as I mentioned before, Hutterites do invent, and in fact, this they invented is called the bigger digger. Now, they don't believe in pride, but they do sometimes make little comments that make you think that they do think about the things they invent. Because you have to ask, what is the bigger digger than? It is bigger than any other digger that existed before. They invented a four-row potato digger, which had never existed before. And one of the things is Hutterites don't believe in competing with outsiders for economic prowess. And often what happens is when they invent something, outsiders will take their ideas and patent it and make money on it, which is, of course, very frustrating, as you can imagine, to people who have invented for their own reasons, not to make money for others. Hutterites use humor as a way to sublimate aggression. As I said before, inherent in human life is aggression. But there are ways that one can cooperate. There's also ways that one can communicate unpleasant or necessary kinds of things in a way that gets the message across. So humor is used a lot. And most Hutterite colonies are very pleasant and fun places to be because there's a lot of laughter and there's a lot of humor and a lot of joking going on. And here is in a wood shop. Actually, this is the old. There's a new, this colony now has already a new advanced version of this wood shop, which this is an old one that just exhausted things out. I don't know, the new one's so advanced, I don't even know how to describe it. And this is one of the Hutterite men creating carpentry. Again, the interdependency of men and women. Men build and women finish. So men will build a house, the women will do all the sanding, the varnishing, and the painting in it. So in Hutterite life, people work together in all aspects for their life. And in this case, this is a Hutterite carpenter building a casket. And you might ask, why in the middle of these slides do I have this? And part of it is because in Hutterite life, if you live in community, Hutterites don't fear death. They look forward to going to their heavenly reward. And so in Hutterite life, a death is actually a time, other than for a marriage, it's the only community work will cease and everyone will come together. And for some people, this sometimes at a colony, there will be 600 people at a funeral. Just as for a wedding, there may be 300 or 400 people there for a week for a wedding. So the major things in life, birth, death, and marriage, are celebrated, the rituals, the rites of passage, with everyone being involved and participating. And now we're moving to romance. Now, this may not look like romance to you, but Hutterite young women and young men know that this is the beginning of romance. During the harvest season, the elders will know who's available in colonies around North America, in terms of Canada and the United States, eligible and respectably hardworking young men. And they'll get invited down to a colony where there are lovely young ladies who are unattached, and they'll be invited to work during the harvest season. Because then the young men and young women between 15 and 24 or 25 are generally working together 8 to 10 hours a day. It gives them plenty of time to evaluate each other. And they evaluate each other not based on what kind of tennis shoes they're wearing or what kind of lipstick or fingernail polish they have on, but they evaluate each other based on cooperation, good humor, hard work, and pleasantness. They're looking at marriage partners for life, since there's no divorce and no one makes them get married. This is a very important time in a young person's life to demonstrate not only their capacity to be a cooperative member of the colony, but to look at potential marriage partners. And here you see some young ladies working, and they're cutting potatoes. And there they are working again. What you don't see is the young men bringing the tractors and the trailers and all of the stuff in and looking them over as they're working. They're looking at the young men are looking at them. And this, at the end of the harvest season, what they have is to celebrate the bringing in of the harvest is what they call a hachinko, which is a harvest celebration. And again, the humor, the young women in this particular colony, I think they use nylon stockings, and they made potato bodies of all of the people who helped in the harvest. And there was actually one of, this is the head elder, and it looked just like him. It had little round glasses and a big round potato body. So, and he's, what he's doing is now people are being honored for their contribution with humor and little stories about what they did during the harvest. And here are the young men, young women singing, and I'll guarantee you right off the slide are the young men looking at them singing. So, and again, if you know Hutterite culture, which of course you may or may not, you can actually tell the difference in colonies by the way women are dressed. This girl, of course, is not the same as a girl in a vest, so she's from a different kind of a colony. So single unmarried girls from other colonies are also invited to add to the fun. So harvest season is a time of hard work and community spirit, particularly for young men and young women. And here's more Hutterite romancing or potential romancing. These are young people visiting in Canada. What you don't see is they're having a nice little snack and a visit together. And these are Washington State, the two girls dressed in black, Washington State Hutterite youth. And in the background are some of their relatives. Again, you can see by the polka dots on the shawls on the girls' hair, on the girls' heads that they're different from the girls in Washington State. But out of the picture are the elders and the family members. They want them to participate. And should a young man or a young woman find a potential mate, the first people they ask about his or her character is their family. Because they want to know. They don't want to make a mistake. And so families, again, are first and foremost important in every aspect of your decision making, because you look to your elders to learn and not make mistakes. And here's another little slide I think is interesting. Here's two young Hutterite men on Saturday night, all dressed up on Saturday night. They got their cowboy boots on, their hat on. And when I saw them out there displaying themselves on the lawn, right? I thought, oh, I'll get the picture before the girls show up. But guess what? Children believe they have love from everyone. So before I could get out there with my camera, they were covered with babies and children, all looking for an empty lap. So here comes Grandma to shoo away the children because this is what they were waiting for. And this is what you see. And this will harken back to many of your youth. If you grew up 30 or 40 years ago, you probably, if you grew up in a small town, had a life not much different than this in terms of spending time together, that it was the social life together and not what you were doing in other ways that was the most important aspect of your life.
And actually now, I'm going to conclude these slides with the rite of passage of marriage, because we've seen birth, we've seen death, and what we see in between, of course, is marriage and the creation of new life. And in Hutterite culture, again, every aspect of life is integrated. So if you're a little girl and you want to know what's going on with the older kids, you can participate as long as you don't get in the way. You can see what I had here in the background. So, and actually that's my son who was invited to attend a Hutterite wedding. And you will recognize some of the people here, including the young man in the middle who just had a very tragic accident. We're very happy he survived a semi-truck collision. And they're going to put him back together, but his face, I understand right now, does not look like it once did. It couldn't look like that. So, and here's, unfortunately, we've lost a relative here, but she's got her little nieces down here, all dressed for the wedding. And as opposed to American weddings, as you may or may not know, around the world, different cultures use different colors to celebrate weddings. In the United States, we think of white. In Hutterite culture, blue is the wedding dress color. So what you'll see is a field of blue, beautiful blue dresses on during the wedding. And since Hutterites only get married once, they don't just get married in 2 hours. The celebration goes on for days and days and weeks. And the family comes, and there are celebrations at the girls' colony, and then the girl eventually marries into the boys' colony, and it will culminates in a wedding service on a Sunday morning. But prior to that, during the week prior to that, they have celebrations every night with singing and merriment to celebrate the impending nuptials. And here are the young women waiting outside the church because the church is full of guests. And again, you can see the blue and purple's kind of sneaking in there as a little new, I guess, novelty in terms of the Hutterite wedding colors. And so they're waiting for the bride and groom to come out. And here's the new couple out, and he is with his groomsmen, and she's come out. And this is one of four wedding dresses that she will make for her wedding services. So they'll be subtly different, but she'll have four wedding dresses. And she makes her groom's shirts. So she's already, even before marriage, given the pattern for his shirt sizes. She will be making all of his clothing, including his outerwear from now on. Her future kinspeople will provide that for her. And here's the couples are now, they're parading back to go look at the wedding gifts and look at the wedding cakes. Oh. Now, Hutterites don't believe in competing. I want you to know this. Now, as I said, you know, when you have aggression, there's something you can do with it besides hurting other people. You can sublimate it. And what Hutterites do is they do compete. They're human beings. They're just like us. You can tell by the cakes that they compete. But they compete in productive ways, productive social ways that mutually benefit everyone. And here you see a wedding cake with a lock, you see a Bible. I've seen wedding cakes that were computers. There was a couple that got married where they love computers, and some of the girls made a blue computer wedding cake with the announcement on the screen. I was at a wedding where, at the same wedding, where a colony couldn't bring the wedding cake and they brought the cake mix and put it on the table. So that gives you some idea of the sense of humor that they have. And so people come and admire this, and I said, well, how do you eat all this? And how do you get a cake like that from 100 miles away or 200 miles away? Well, afterwards, many of the families stay, the new kinspeople will stay for a week or two to help the young woman settle into her new colony, help her with her new home, and they celebrate for another week or two. So there's plenty of people to help them eat their cakes. And here's the young couple now in their new apartment, and they will generally live, a new couple, a newly married couple will live in the basement apartment of the father and mother-in-law of the groom. So it for the young bride, then she has people in the colony who are relatives to help her integrate in the colony, because she goes to a strange colony. A man from birth to death will be in the same colony, except when they fission, where he may end up in a new colony with his bride or his wife. And now they're marching into the bridal feast. And this is the one time that a husband and wife will sit together. They'll sit together during the wedding and the prenuptial ceremonies at the head table with their kinsmen and women. And outsiders are invited to these services. This is a teacher in the foreground. And what you'll see is the men dressed in outfits in the background. Men take care of the women to symbolize the importance of women who always serve and feed men during the bridal services. During the nuptial parties, the men serve and feed the women, as well as the men. So again, these oppositions indicate how important the embedded and mutually dependent and cooperative relationships are in a colony in terms of producing people. Okay. And then to conclude, this is the afterwards people enjoy their time watching activities, baseball. They play cooperative games. They don't believe in aggressive individual competition in school or in play. And to conclude, life is very pastoral in Hutterite life. So what they do is they have a culture that generates and replicates nonviolence and cooperation and sublimation of aggression into productive cultural activities which benefit one for all and all for one. Okay, if I could have the lights, and I'm going to conclude. I just want to make a last little statement. And then what I'd like to do is, it's 10 o'clock, so any of you who want to leave can feel free to leave, and I'd like to invite John up to take any kinds of questions you have. And so I think that the important thing to say about violence is we have models in America, and I think all of you who are here already know what we need to do to create a nonviolent society. The issue is, how can we spread the word? What are we as people going to do to help promote and spread the idea of cooperation, community, spirituality, and passivity as opposed to aggressiveness in society? Thank you very much. And I'd like to invite John up, and if you have questions, please feel free to ask him about his colony life, or if it's anything that I can answer a question about, I'd be glad to, because I certainly foreshortened a lot of the things I would have said if I had more time.
I assure everybody, I will not be able to say so much in so little time. I am not only an elder of the community, I also serve as administrator in our private school. I've always been an educator, and it's a necessity in life. It gets more complicated as we progress in technology. There's problems out there, and I suppose there will always be. I have a few things to read to you here, and I'm sure that most of you will agree. Now, nothing comes easy. What we have done and what we are doing at present is nothing new, and it's not a surprise, and we know it works, and that's why we very strongly try to stand by it. Now, I'm going to read you a few things here which relate to what Claudia has put across here tonight. And I want to read you a list of evils which we seriously frown upon. Wealth without work. Knowledge without character. Science without humanity. Pleasure without a conscience. Commerce without morality. Worship without sacrifice. Integrity and moral values are the absolutes. We can have the strongest economy in the world. America has now achieved a level of economic superiority which verges on creating a global monopoly for selling our way of life. And yet, it will all be for naught if we lose our moral bearing, the American family way, or the American family may become our first and foremost casualty. As Claudia has already said, the family is the primary and most important source of moral instruction. I agree that we must strengthen our commitment to model strong families and ourselves to live by godly priorities in a culture where self so often supersedes commitment to others. And as we not only model, but assertively reach out to help others, we must realize that even huge social problems are solved one person at a time. Now I'm coming back again to where I indulge very strongly, and that is in the educational aspect of community life. Hutterites, as a rule, are very selective in who teaches our children. Atheists are frowned upon. Respectable persons whose dedication, integrity, and moral values are not eroded. Teachers as well as school facilities are state accredited. Selective in what is being taught. What is being taught in some public schools is shameful to say the least. We will not tolerate such infiltration. Teachers are strongly informed what we expect. And by such, we not only select a teacher at the first meeting, we want to know more and more till we can seriously say that we have selected a good selection. Teachers are also state accredited. We go to libraries out in the towns and bring in material. Materials are screened. And I'm sure that most of you, especially as parents, know that there is literature out there, there's books out there. There should not be in a school, let alone in a home. And by this, we strongly go after. Claudia, you've never touched on education much, have you?
I leave it to the expert.
Are there any questions you people want to know? I can better function if somebody shoots questions at me.
Yeah, without knowing very much about your earliest history in Europe, I suspect that Gutenberg printed the Bible and your ancestors actually read what was on the page of the Gospels, and your religion has evolved from what Jesus actually said and did rather than the theologians before and after that modified his teachings. Is that right? Your life and teachings are modeled after what Jesus actually said and taught and did.
Modeled after the leader that took it on after the breakaway from the, who was it? Catholics.
Yeah, from the Catholics. What happened was they did read, you know, they read, essentially they read the Latin, and then they read it in German. And then what they had was the Hutterites take their communal life from Acts. And so
Acts 2,
which says that they will all come together and live together communally. And their earliest scriptures were written by men who today the scriptures are still preached. So
their teachings have come down and the wisdoms have come down, and they have a chronicle that goes for 450 years of all the mistakes they've made, and they've made the same mistakes over and over and over again too. So they always go back to the biblical teachings when they make the mistakes, and the wisdom is there, and it hasn't been modified. In fact, the scriptures haven't been modified either.
And the non-violence, of course,
right,
is a given.
Right. I should mention that, talking about scriptures and teachings, our teachings and our scriptures, what are being, for instance, the coming Sunday will be designated as a certain sermon, and that same sermon is preached all over the world among the Hutterites. Those teachings are prepared. Nobody can deviate from that. They can assert power behind it. They can assert
charisma.
They can assert what's the name I want to use here now? Emphasis, but no deviation. No one. The only difference in sermons in each from Sunday to Sunday would be when there's a funeral, or when there is a marriage ceremony, baptismal service, and so on.
Who is it that writes those sermons?
They had been written way back in the 1500s.
1600s, Aaron Price, Jacob Hutter. The name Hutterite came from a man who, like the Amish took their name from a man named Jacob Amon, the Hutterites took their name from a man named Jacob Hutter, which meant hatter in German. And these were charismatic leaders who gave their lives, in the case of the Hutterites and the Amish and Mennonites, who lost their lives by the thousand, burned at the stake. Jacob Hutter was burned at the stake, or he was trying to get some of the Anabaptists out of Germany at the time. So those scriptures exist today, and every preacher, when he becomes a preacher, handwrites scriptures themselves. So that's one of the things they do, is rewrite and transcribe the scriptures for themselves from the ancient texts.
Writes it from the self, not by his own recognition. It is prepared for him.
Yeah. Okay, there was other questions over here,
John. I was just going to ask you, in terms of your utilization of technology, how does the community decide which technologies to use? Which technologies are not used in your community, for instance, television? And then, can you give us an example of a technology that you earlier approved and then later sort of had second thoughts about and decided to disapprove? And pick any of those three.
Oh, go for it. He won't tell you, I'll tell you.
The technology that we look for and put real emphasis on is that are connected to our livelihood. Outside of that.
For example, to tell a little story, radios and televisions are not part of Hutterite's life. Children don't grow up with the kinds of magazines, radios, TVs, VCRs, video games. However, with some of the new equipment that they buy, and they do buy the newest, the latest, the biggest, the best, radios were in the cars, in the trucks. They don't have private automobiles. They have vans so they can carry a number of people. So what was happening is many of the men began to quote the gospel according to Rush Limbaugh and a few other people. Well, in the wisdom of the elders is very important. And the wisdom of the elders came down that those were ungodly mechanisms in those machines. And in fact, they came to visiting. And that's what happens, is because Hutterite culture is a uniform culture, when there are problems, it's culture-wide. They came visiting and they said, you will take those radios out of those vans, even if they were put in. You'll have a hole there. So that's a big issue. That's an example of just recently moving back. And that's the great thing about Hutterite society, is if they move too, they become too worldly, because there's always gossip as an informal mechanism of social control, the word gets around all of the Hutterite culture, and a colony either has to bear the shame or change.
Don't call it gossip, call it grapevine.
Grapevine, excuse me. Because I can't compete. What's your word? It's not competition, it's what is that? They don't have, they have other words, but, you know, the translation from German to English is kind of hard. Whatever it is, it works.
Can't think of it.
Okay, you have no way.
Is there a way, if you're not born into the community, to become a member of the community? And also, is there a way, if you're born into the community, to leave the community?
Yes, there is. The doors are open. Both ways. Mind you, we've had a lot of experience with that, and some very harsh disappointments.
In fact, Hutterites have had the experience that most, through their history, that most people that come from the outside that are not born Hutterites, that are not socialized, because their socialization language, of course, is Hutterish, which is a combination of all their diaspora languages while they were persecuted all over Europe. So if you're not born into it, most of the experiences, nobody lasts more than 10 years. So they're very reluctant, and it's usually males who want to come in, and then they want to marry and have a family. And actually, I went through a baptism ceremony of a young man who they did allow in, and it looks like he's going to make it. But they talked about the fact that, you know, what their experience is that they lose a whole family. So there is Hutterite defection. There are three subgroups of Hutterites. There's a Hutterite called Dariuslite, which John and his relatives here are all part of. There's a Shmuelite, which means blacksmith's people, and there's a Laralite, which means teacher's people. And what happened was when they came from Russia to the United States, they settled in South Dakota, and they settled under the leadership of these three different groups. And each group is a little bit different, even though you might not see the differences. I would see them, anybody that studied them. And each group has a different defection rate. The Darius have a very low defection rate. And part of it is that they fission at 120. And what they know, which it takes a PhD for some people to know, is that you get bigger than a face-to-face group, you get over 120, and you can't monitor each other's behavior, and then you'll start getting problem in a colony. So they fission. Other groups, like the Shmuelite, will get up to 300, and the young men will leave. Nobody's keeping an eye on them, and they can make money on the outside, so they get more defection. So what happens is it depends on, again, the subcultural context, which creates social problems. So that's, so there is some more defection in different groups. John,
To whom were the Hutterites a threat? To account for the horrible persecutions that the European colonies have gone through, and what was that threat? I mean, the group was persecuted as heretics, I think.
The biggest threat to
religions.
The most severest and biggest threat to the Hutterites back in the 1500s, when the Reformation and all this took place, was through infant baptism. Could not see that.
See, there was no separation of church and state. The Catholics, right. Just as the Muslim world is run by Islam today, and there's no separation of church and state in Saudi Arabia, the Catholic Church was the voice in Europe. And so, essentially, they were heretics. They were a threat to establish social order. So, when they said, we won't kill in the name of God, and the Catholics, of course, were killing anybody that was a heretic, and we believe that a child should not be baptized, i.e. become a Catholic, and therefore have to pay to the church, tithe of the church, essentially they were threatening the church, so the church burned them at the stake, did what they needed to do to try and eradicate it. There's another one over here.
My question is actually for Claudia.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, after having studied the communities for 7 years and having one, you know, and yet having a life in our society, how has your study and your relationship with the communities, how has it impacted your own life? Is the distortions between the two, is that difficult for you to synthesize?
Boy, that's a tough question. I guess for me, I got a lot more than a PhD from the Hutterites. I have to say that my degree was a community effort. I mean, I didn't just write a dissertation. Hutterites don't let many people in. There are, in fact, very few Hutterite scholars in the United States or Canada, and so I feel very honored. But more important, one of the things they told me was they thought that academics are the only people they know that can work for a living, get paid for doing nothing. And they particularly make fun of men doing it. So at least I know how to cook and sew, and I'm a woman, so I had some value. But when I did my dissertation, it was a community effort, meaning
They read it. And they used to complain about, you know, all these academics, they never get it right. They come in here, they come in for a week, they know it all, but they know nothing. I said, well, fine, this will be our mistake. So this was essentially, the people you see here read, they didn't always like what I had to say, but they read it, they acknowledged that the accuracy was there, or at least I wasn't inaccurate, and they didn't censor what I had to say. So I'd say that, you know, what I've gained is a larger sense of kinship. I think that when you hear me talk about what people need, I've grown and developed as a human being because I have a larger world of understanding of what it takes to socialize. You know, I was a social worker for CPS. I've worked as a child mental health therapist. I've worked in all these areas where I've seen my own kind say things that don't make sense to me anymore. So I'm an ongoing student of their culture. I'm not a finished product by any means, as they will tell you.